Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
This is the Most Lucrative Master's Degree by Eric Jenkins. As Americans are becoming increasingly conscious about the cost and debt associated with higher education, it's helpful to understand which graduate degrees offer the biggest and the smallest bang for the buck. A new analysis from compensation tracking company PayScale reveals that nurse anesthesia is the most lucrative master's degree in America, according to financial outlet Moneyish, which commissioned the study. Nurse anesthetists administer anesthesia, monitor patients' vital signs, and oversee patient recovery from anesthesia, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They have both the highest early career and mid-career median salaries at $143,000 to $165,000, respectively. Coming in second is telecommunications engineering, which PayScale's data says pulls a median salary of $141,000 by mid-career. Several other engineering degrees cracked the top 10, including electrical engineering, number 4 at $130,000 mid-career, computer engineering, number 5 at $129,000, and biomedical engineering, tied at 5, also at $129,000. Looking for something in the financial world? Consider a master's degree in finance and economics, number 3, for a chance to take home $134,000 by mid-career, or corporate finance, which has a median salary of $126,000. Degrees in mathematics and statistics, technology management, and computer science round out the top 10. And if money is the primary motivation for earning a master's degree, PayScale's data suggests avoiding this one field of study in particular, human services, with a mid-career median pay of $46,600. It is the graduate degree with the lowest salary prospects. President Trump still hasn't spoken to his top general in Afghanistan. By W.J. Hennigan. President Trump has yet to speak with the U.S. general in command of forces in Afghanistan, despite approving a new military strategy earlier this year that committed more troops and funding for America's longest war. "I haven't spoken with him," General John W. Nicholson, Jr., U.S. commander in Afghanistan, told reporters November 8th in Brussels. The lack of contact between the commander-in-chief and the top military official in Afghanistan is unusual. Nicholson said he spoke to President Barack Obama twice in the 10 months they overlapped. The general's comments came in response to questions about whether he felt Trump had confidence in him as commander. Reports over the summer indicated that President was considering firing Nicholson over lack of progress in Afghanistan. But Nicholson said he felt Trump had faith in him despite not having had a face-to-face meeting or phone call. "Yes, I believe I have his confidence," Nicholson told reporters. "And I say that because the policy that we received on August 21st is everything that I asked for." In a primetime address to the nation that night, Trump authorized a new plan that allowed the military to deploy more than 3,000 additional troops who would advise Afghan forces and work more closely with local commanders. The White House also granted the Pentagon more leeway in launching airstrikes against the Taliban, Islamic State-affiliated militants, and other insurgents, which has thrown the war-torn nation into further disarray. A United Nations review of the security situation recently stated that Afghanistan's declining security threatened the gains achieved. "The conflict is an eroding stalemate in which the Taliban have increased the territory they are able to contest and, in some cases, have begun to consolidate their hold," the UN said. "There are now about 14,000 American and 6,500 NATO troops inside Afghanistan. 11 U.S. service members have been killed in action in 2017, two more than last year."
Olympic gymnast Ali Raisman reveals sexual abuse by team doctor Larry Nassar. By Alice Park. Ali Raisman, the six-time Olympic medalist and one of the most accomplished gymnasts in U.S. history, says she was sexually abused by Dr. Larry Nassar, who worked as the women's gymnastics national team doctor for decades. Raisman is the second member of the gold medal-winning 2012 Olympic women's team to accuse Nassar of abuse. In October, her teammate Michaela Maroney tweeted that Nassar molested her for years, beginning when she was 13. Raisman disclosed the abuse in an interview scheduled to air Sunday on CBS's 60 Minutes, as well as in her new book, Fierce. Nasser, who worked as a volunteer doctor for USA Gymnastics, is currently in jail awaiting sentencing after pleading guilty to child pornography charges in Michigan. He's also named in more than 100 lawsuits filed by gymnasts and athletes he treated while working with USA Gymnastics and at Michigan State University. Those suits claim he sexually abused athletes under the guise of medical treatment. Nasser resigned from USA Gymnastics in the summer of 2015. In the interview, Raisman says she spoke to FBI investigators about Nasser after competing at the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro in 2016, after an investigation by the Indianapolis Star revealed that USA Gymnastics had a policy of not reporting sexual abuse reports unless they were filed by the victims or a parent. Raisman, who competed on the 2012 and 2016 Olympic teams and is the nation's second most decorated female Olympic gymnast, is pushing for change at USA Gymnastics, which governs the sport and oversees the selection of world and Olympic teams. "I am angry," she said in the 60 Minutes interview. "I just want to create change so that young girls never, ever have to go through this." In a statement to the program, USA Gymnastics said it has adopted new policies that require mandatory reporting of any potential abuse. "USA Gymnastics is very sorry that any athlete has been harmed. We want to work with Allie and all interested athletes to keep athletes safe."
The last thing Iran wants is a full-on war with Saudi Arabia. Here's why. By K. Arman Sejoy. On the day Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman jailed rival princes and gathered about his robes the trappings of power, a missile screamed toward the airport of Riyadh, the kingdom's capital. It was shot down before it could reach the earth, but the Saudi government claimed to know every detail about where it came from. It was an Iranian missile launched by Hezbollah from territory occupied by the Houthis in Yemen, Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeer declared to CNN 3 days later, on November 6, naming allies of Tehran. Direct military aggression by the Iranian regime, the Crown Prince added a day later. So it goes between the two great Muslim powers of the Middle East, the Sunni Kingdom and the Shiite Republic, locked in a rivalry only rarely declared so nakedly. Most of the time, especially in recent years, Saudi Arabia and Iran fight through proxies, and Iran is winning most of them on evidence less dramatic than a missile launch. In Iraq, millions of Shiite pilgrims are now gathering in the cities of Najaf and Karbala for the annual Arba'een ritual. Millions are arriving from neighboring Iran, which has cemented a deep alliance with Iraq since the nominally secular but Sunni dictator Saddam Hussein was toppled by the U.S. in 2003. Today, the Shiite sense of brotherhood between the two nations is more robust than it has been for centuries, as is the cooperation between governments. The popular mobilization forces called the Al-Hashd al-Shabai, based on the Iranian Basaj paramilitary force, outmatches the official Iraqi army in both manpower and morale. In Syria, the government of Bashar al-Assad would have collapsed years ago without the help of the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah, Russian air power solicited by Iran and Iranian soldiers, euphemistically referred to as military advisors. The combined forces are slowly but steadily taking back land from both ISIS and other groups of rebels that the Saudis had backed. In Yemen, where Saudi Arabia had hoped for a quick and decisive victory when it led an armed attack in 2015 in support of the country's official President Mansour al-Hadi, it has instead become bogged down in a costly war of attrition with the Zaidi Houthis, a Shiite sect that drew much closer to Iran after the Saudi attack. Yet the reaction from the Islamic Republic to Saudi bellicosity has been uncharacteristically muted. While strongly denying any role in arming the Houthis, Tehran has limited itself to calling for peace and unity and blaming Mohammed bin Salman's accusations on problems inside the kingdom. If you have internal problems in Saudi Arabia, try to solve these problems. Why do you seek to make problems for others because of your own problems? Why do you speak against the countries of the region? Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said in a cabinet meeting on Wednesday, according to Iran's official news agency, IRNA. For Iran, an escalation of the proxy wars into a direct confrontation with Saudi Arabia would be counterproductive, to say the least, especially since events on the ground are going their way, at least for the time being. Iran is not eager to test Saudi Arabia's modern and state-of-the-art military hardware purchased from the United States at a price tag of billions of dollars. And attacking the birthplace of Islam with the two most holy sites of Islam in Mecca and Medina would be akin to propaganda suicide in the Islamic world, with the potential for uniting every Muslim in the world against them. It's no accident that Saudi kings style themselves as the custodian of the two holy mosques. Today, Iran has much more to lose than it did a decade and a half ago. Before the American wars following 9/11, the Islamic Republic had been boxed in by the Taliban's Afghanistan to the east and Saddam Hussein's Iraq to the west. At that time, international concern over its nuclear program was making Iran a pariah state, its only regional ally being Syria and the sections of Lebanon where Hezbollah held sway. But now, especially after the 2015 nuclear deal it reached with global superpowers, the influence of the Islamic Republic runs high in many Middle Eastern capitals and beyond. Tehran played host to Russian President Vladimir Putin and hopes to have French President Emmanuel Macron pay an official visit in what would be a first since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Barely a week goes by without the Islamic Republic's most traveled foreign minister, Javad Zarif, either hosting foreign diplomats or visiting them around the world. The Islamic Republic, finally within sight of its goals of becoming the region's dominant power, considers a direct military confrontation with the House of Saud, which they believe to be on the verge of collapse, as far from desirable. Discretion, in their view, is the better part of valor. Will Taylor Swift's new album, Reputation, make her the richest woman in entertainment? By Jennifer Kalfas and Lucinda Shen. She may have declared the old Taylor Swift as dead, but the net worth she has accrued is certainly alive and well. With her sixth studio album, Reputation, expected to hit stores Friday, Taylor Swift's already massive wealth will undoubtedly grow with album sales, merchandise sales, and her likely upcoming tour. Still, Swift has ways to go if she plans to become the country's wealthiest female entertainer. That title currently belongs to Oprah Winfrey by a long shot. Winfrey was worth $3.1 billion as of May, according to Forbes. Though her first album released more than a decade ago, Swift has expanded her career from a Nashville-based country singer to one of the most famous pop stars and highest-paid musicians of her generation. Here's how she made her wealth. How much is Taylor Swift worth? According to Forbes, Swift has a net worth of $280 million, the ninth richest of all female entertainers in the U.S. From June 2015 to June 2016, Swift made the most of any other musician with a record $170 million, according to Forbes' 2016 list. That's because of her wildly popular tour following the release of her fifth album, 1989. The star-studded, high-grossing tours sold out stadiums across the country. Taylor Swift's albums and tours. With five studio albums, each with tours that followed, and her upcoming new Reputation release, Swift has made a sizable profit from her music and promotion of it. The country star-turned-pop star made a killing on her popular star-studded 1989 tour in 2015, which grossed $184.5 million, according to Billboard. Her first foray into pop singing, 1984, was the best-selling album of 2014 in the U.S. While 1989 was her best-selling albums, her previous records all shot up to the top spot of the U.S. charts and those in other countries and have sold millions of copies. While her singles from Reputation haven't received similar critical acclaim as those from 1984 did, it's likely the album will sell well, thanks in part to her loyal fan base and status in the industry. Taylor Swift endorsements. Swift's wealth expands beyond her music. A darling of the industry, the singer-songwriter has been named one of the most marketable in the industry today, and her track record of endorsements shows. Swift has had several high-profile endorsement deals, including one with Keds, Diet Coke, CoverGirl, and perhaps most notoriously, Apple. The singer partnered with the company after she wrote an open letter to Apple CEO Tim Cook about issues she had with how Apple Music paid its artists during a 3-month trial period for customers. Still, the singer's upcoming album won't immediately appear on Apple Music when it becomes available November 10. Apple listeners will have to wait a week for it to appear on the streaming site, according to Bloomberg. Taylor Swift's homes. With enormous wealth comes enormous real estate. Just weeks ahead of her album release, Swift closed a deal on a new $18 million townhouse in the affluent neighborhood of Tribeca in New York City, right next door to her penthouse. But while her $2 million homes in New York are right next to each other, Swift also has homes elsewhere around the country. She has a $25 million mansion in Beverly Hills, California, a $17 million seaside home in Rhode Island, and a $2 million penthouse in Nashville.
7 Questions with Mavis Staples by Riza Bruner. The soul singer and civil rights activist talks collaborating with Bob Dylan, memories of Martin Luther King Jr., and a new album, If All I Was Black, out November 17th. Time. You've made 15 studio albums. What inspired you to get back into the studio? Staples. We're living in trying times right now. What I'm seeing on the news really makes me feel like I'm back in the 60s. These are songs that will inspire people to do better, to love one another, to come together. One of the songs goes, "There's evil in the world and there's evil in me," and you go on to say you're going to try harder. What do you mean by that? We should try harder to love one another. I feel compassion, and I want you to feel the same compassion. We have a man in the White House who started a resurgence of bigotry and hate. The way he talks and the way he portrays himself, what he says doesn't make sense. It doesn't make good sense. And it's spreading. It's spreading. Another song, We Go High, references Michelle Obama's 2016 Democratic National Convention speech. Why did you include that line? When she said that, I just jumped. It's something that we as black people do. When they call us names, when they talk about us, when we get knocked down, we don't stay down. We get back up. You have this persistent optimism. What's your secret to staying hopeful? I just believe. It's not just for black people, what I'm singing about. It's to bring us all together. I've seen us have a black government. That's something I never thought I'd see. As far as us coming together as one, I'm going to keep on praying. But I don't think I'm going to see us coming together like that in my lifetime. When I saw that man marching in Charlottesville with torches, my mind was going, the next thing they're going to do is torch a cross. I've seen burning crosses. The only thing that's different is that the Charlottesville marchers didn't have white sheets over them. My heart gets heavy, but when I sing these songs, I get lifted. What's it like to work with Jeff Tweedy as a producer and writer when you're making this music? He didn't want to release the song If All I Was Black, and he definitely didn't want it to be the title of the album. So I had to tell him, Tweedy, you are black. You know me inside and out, and I know you. You're black. Jeff Tweedy is a person who has beauty and good in his heart. This is my 3rd album with him. He's a poet. You're heading on tour with your longtime friend and collaborator, Bob Dylan. Why do you like working with him? We met when I was 17 and Bobby was 16. He's a good friend, and this is what friends do. We come together. I've heard that you guys were once more than friends. We were courting, and we would snuggle every now and then. He proposed, but I felt like I was too young. I'm older now. I just might propose to him. I don't know what might happen. The world would be shocked if Bob and I got married, so I won't do that. I'm just happy we're friends. Do you ever get tired of the constant grind from all the work you're doing? I've been doing this since 1960. When we met Dr. King in church, my father told us that if he can preach it, we can sing it. We've been singing the message songs ever since. Every year people tell me, Mavis, my goodness, when are you going to retire? I'm almost 80 years old, but I'm not ready to retire. This is what God wants me to do. My voice is as strong as ever. The resistance helped Democrats win on Tuesday. Now they're turning to 2018. By Charlotte Alter. The Democrats' surprise sweep in the November 7th off-year... The Democrats' surprise sweep in the November 7 off-year elections wasn't just a major victory for the party. It was a triumph months in the making for a network of progressive groups that did not even exist a year ago, but have been toiling to train candidates, boost turnout, and energize activists in state and local races. Run for Something, which recruits and trains progressive millennial candidates to run for state and local office, helped 10 young candidates run for Virginia House of Delegates. 7 of them won, and 2 others are headed for a recount. Overall, of the 72 first-time candidates Run for Something endorsed nationwide, 46% won, a huge jump over the paltry average success rate for first-time candidates. Flippable, another upstart progressive organization which tries to turn local swing districts blue, sent more than $150,000 to 5 targeted races in Virginia, where Democrats may have won enough seats, pending recounts, to control the Commonwealth's House of Delegates, where Republicans held a 66-34 majority. Of the 20 races they targeted in Virginia, Washington, and Florida, they won 16. Sister District, which redirects volunteers in safe blue states to assist with competitive races elsewhere, made nearly 19,000 calls and knocked on more than 3,000 doors to help elect Cheryl Turpin, a Virginia House of Delegates candidate from a Trump district. Overall, Sister District won 13 out of the 14 races they targeted. The lesson, says Run for Something co-founder Amanda Littman, is to compete in every local election you can, because you just might win. We were working in the districts that nobody else was engaging because they didn't see them as winnable, Littman says. She sees the surprise victories in Virginia as a vindication of that strategy. It means we need to double down, get as big as we possibly can, run as many candidates as possible, and focus on good talent and strong campaigns. The successes on Tuesday should give a boost to that strategy. According to Littman, Run for Something normally gets about 10 requests a day from interested young candidates. In the 24 hours since the polls closed in Virginia, she heard from 100 new candidates. Other organizers see Tuesday's outcome as a signal to campaign everywhere. Before yesterday, we might have said, let's work on these close states, says Flippable CEO Catherine Vaughn. Now we're seeing more possibility in states where it seems like the odds are stacked against us. Activists are taking the hint. Indivisible, one of the biggest and best organized groups in the so-called resistance, announced on Thursday a new plan to transform their well-trained network of anti-Trump advocates into a standing army of volunteers for the 2018 midterms. Their new electoral handbook, Indivisible 435, provides guidelines on how to endorse a candidate and how to help with voter registration. The aim, organizers say, is to transform the oppositional energy that helped defeat the push to repeal the Affordable Care Act into a surge of positive momentum going into the 2018 midterms. The goal is always to provide that really localized strategic advice so that our groups can mirror this scale everywhere, says Maria Urbina, political director of Indivisible. So regardless of what turf they're in, they can use these tools. There are more than 6,000 Indivisible groups nationwide, with at least 2 in every congressional district. That means progressive congressional candidates will go into 2018 with at least 2 well-organized networks of possible volunteers to seek out and tap into. So far, Indivisible is the biggest resistance group to target all 435 congressional districts instead of picking and choosing winnable races. Its transition from activist group to political machine has already begun. Candidates who'd started as Indivisible members ran in and won tough local races in Michigan, Connecticut, and Virginia. Indivisible was largely responsible for the well-organized opposition to ACA repeal, which resulted in furious town halls and embarrassing optics for GOP legislators. While GOP representatives could and did avoid their angry constituents during the health care debate, it's a lot harder to hide when you're running for re-election. Urbina won't comment on whether Indivisible plans to continue its heckling spree, saying only that we are holding members accountable. Indivisible is hardly the only group attempting to turn activism into votes. The Women's Convention in October, organized by the same activists that planned January's Women's March, featured detailed training sessions to coach people how to get out the vote and run for office. Immigration rights advocates spent the weekend canvassing for local candidates in Virginia. Organizers hope that if they can turn the wave of anti-Trump activism into voters and door knockers, they can rebuild the progressive bench. Which is why, for the groups that have been targeting local elections since last November, Virginia's blue wave is only the beginning. It's a signal to keep going, says Vaughn. What we're doing is working. What Happens When Women Reach a Critical Mass of Influence? By J. Newton Small. Newton Small, a Time contributor, is the CEO of Memory Well and author of Broad Influence. If it seems like the structures that enable sexism are exploding, that's because they scientifically are, according to the theory of critical mass. When women reached 20% in the Senate, they went after the Pentagon to reform the military's sexual assault protocol. When they reached 25% of Hollywood producers, they took down Harvey Weinstein and his casting couch culture. And when they reached a third of the White House press corps, Fox's Roger Ailes, NPR's Michael Oreskes, and other serial harassers in the media began to get called out. Somewhere in that zone, when women comprise 20-30% of an institution, things begin to change. Critical mass has its roots in physics. It's the amount of material needed to sustain a nuclear explosion. Accumulate enough, set it off, and there is no other outcome but boom. The concept has been used in sociology for decades. After the Supreme Court's 1954 Brown v. Board of Education decision, experts recommended that a minimum critical mass of minority students be integrated into schools. Later in the 1970s, after the Navy was required to integrate its ships following a 1978 district court decision, it began with one woman and then a handful of women. It was a disaster for all involved. Through trial and error, it struck upon the idea of critical mass. Now all ships are required to have at least 20% women on board. Studies show that when corporate boards reach critical mass, companies become more efficient, make more money, and have to restate earnings less frequently. And having a critical mass of women on group courts has led to many more cases of bias being considered, studies show. But the media and Hollywood are two of the highest-profile occupations in America, and fame has benefits. Famous women calling out their harassers by name emboldens women across the country. The focus and attention paid to these scandals will help shine a light on other sectors. This is only the beginning. Women first stormed the workforce as Rosie the Riveters during World War II. The U.S. would not have won that war if women hadn't brought in the crops and built the weapons. And it will be economic necessity that will bring women fully into the workforce. By 2030, the baby boomer generation will have fully aged beyond retirement eligibility, and America will be short 26 million workers. Two obvious ways to address that shortfall: bring in a ton of new immigrants, which is hard to imagine in this political climate, or bring women up to full employment, which would add 23 million more workers to the workforce. Parity. What can we do to help? Count ourselves. When I was researching my book, Broad Influence, I had to go to all 15 departments of the government, the White House, and four labor unions to figure out that women made up 30% of the upper levels of the civil service and political appointees. We think there should be plenty of data out there about women, but the truth is there isn't. Hollywood has the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media, which tracks Tinseltown, but there's almost no official tracking of newsrooms. My one-third number is an unofficial headcount taken by me looking around at my colleagues. And other industries are worse. Consulting groups like McKinsey and Ernst & Young track women in the workforce, but their numbers are reported in aggregate and companies are guaranteed secrecy when they participate. In recent years, people have begun to wake up to the dearth of data on women. Melinda Gates, Generation W, and the Wilson Center's Women in Public Service Project have all recently launched data collection initiatives. So, what comes next? Ask your company how many women they have in management and report it. Ask your local police force how many female officers they have. Look around you. School boards, zoning commissions, local corporations. Few of these have holistic gender data collection. Until we know where we stand, it will be hard to know how close to critical mass we are and when things can go boom. Men are finally waking up to sexual harassment, but they still have a lot to learn. By Susanna Schrobsdorf. Susanna Schrobsdorf is the Chief Strategic Partnerships Editor and a columnist at Time. Over the past few weeks, I've had discussions I never thought I'd have. Guys, former colleagues, and current friends asking me if something they did a decade ago or last year upset me or made me uncomfortable. I don't think I ever crossed a line, but they trail off as if waiting for me to finish that sentence with an accusation or an assurance. Or they're in fact apologizing for some comment I'd blocked out. Some friends are also describing moments of doubt they're now having about their behavior with women at work. Should he have put his arm around her waist for a photo? Was that text suggestive? It's good that men are asking questions. These conversations should be one of the few upsides of the disturbing hashtag MeToo stories we've been hearing from women in almost every profession about sexual harassment and worse. But in these conversations with men, I've been doing what I've always done. Brush it off. Oh, don't worry. I didn't take it that way. It was a long time ago. I don't even remember. But here's the thing. If I can't tell my male friends or men whom I no longer work with that their behavior was out of line, who can? And they need to hear it. I've learned in talking to more than a few men recently that some of them really are unaware of their effect on women. And whether it's for shame or fear or to avoid trouble, some of us haven't been telling them. This is not to excuse the serial predators and rapists we've been reading about, but there are ordinary men who have been rattled by the barrage. They're just waking up to how little they knew about how women move through the world. Recently, an Instamotor survey found that 2 out of 3 men don't think repeated unwanted invitations to drinks, dinner, or dates is sexual harassment. One man commented on the survey, saying, "If everyone thinks that asking a colleague out for dinner is harassment, no wonder everyone is so lonely and frustrated." A woman jumped into the comments and pointed out that he'd skimmed right over the words repeated and unwanted. Oh, right. Even journalists who've spent a few decades covering sexual harassment in politics haven't entirely understood the problem. Which is a problem. After hearing from female colleagues, The Washington Post's Dana Milbank recently wrote, "How could I have possibly missed all of this?" Milbank says that men at his workplace weren't conspiring to be silent. It's more that they were in a cone of ignorance. The kind of ignorance that let him think of a workplace predator as a playboy and a harmless scamp without understanding that the scampery was a clue. There are other men who have gone on the record as being that guy, the one who thought he was being bold when he was really pushing a woman too far. Others are posting on Facebook asking their peers to apologize if they've done things like catcalled a girl because you thought she was hot. And, of course, there are still guys who are defensive and confused. In a career spanning 40 years, I have never personally witnessed a single act of sexual harassment or discrimination of any kind, full stop, period, amen, wrote a commenter on a story about the sexual harassment survey. Some tried to turn the tables. Women are just clueless about the effects of tight sweaters, cleavage. Others are heading backward. I am going to begin completely ignoring women. I won't talk to them, look at them, ask them out, date them, do business with them, hire them, or have anything to do with them. Lonely? Yes. Better than being unemployed or in jail? Yes. You win, ladies. Enjoy your victory. And then there are the men who believe that not taking no for an answer is part of courtship. Sorry, but if I gave up every time a woman says no to me, I'd never get anywhere. Quitters never win. So, yes, we've still got a way to go here. Even men who've never doubted women on this topic are a bit stunned when they hear details from someone they know. When a friend asked me whether anything had happened to me, I started listing various incidents, and every time I thought I was finished, I'd remember another. It was like I was rattling off something far less significant, like cities I visited. When I finished, there was a long silence on the other end of the line. I had no idea that this could all happen to one person, he said. I almost laughed because my litany of subway gropes and creepy jokes would not be remarkable for most women. After all, we don't know any different. We grew up in this climate. It's the air we breathe, the water we swim in. We don't run after dark. We don't walk to the car without keys in our hand. This is the way it's always been. Will this new wokening among men change that? I don't think so, but maybe if we're able to talk about it now, it'll be different for our sons and daughters. So this is how men like Weinstein get away with it for so long. By Belinda Luscombe. Belinda Luscombe is an editor-at-large of Time. So this is how it happens. This is how sexual predations go on so long. The conspiracy of silence that protects carnivores is a toxic combination of a phalanx of powerful parties whose job it is to keep their client doing business, plus a cascade of tiny choices made by dozens of individuals who fear for their own fates, are too ashamed to say anything, and are unwilling to judge the sexual behavior of others. Very few accusers can withstand that combination of well-paid mufflers and bystanders who aren't sure how to act. The extent of the machinations to protect Harvey Weinstein's reputation from a ballooning number of accusers have now come to light, and they are legion. According to a new expose in by Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker, the mogul hired a firm started by former Mossad agents to gather unflattering material on his accusers. He deployed friends in the tabloid media to feed him intelligence and dirt about them, and he cajoled former employees to call their colleagues and figure out who was talking to the press. Even the respected lawyer David Boies got involved, signing a contract to help keep Weinstein's feet out of the fire and paying a shadowy information-gathering firm to spy on his accusers. But while Weinstein's legal maneuvering and Bill O'Reilly's huge settlements, including one payout reported to be around $32 million, may have been one of the reasons his victims' voices were silenced so long after the fact, it does not explain the acquiescence of those around him to his predatory habits at the time. As a flood of victims have stepped forward to accuse directors, actors, media executives, journalists, chefs, and others of sexual assault or harassment, it has become horribly clear that while Weinstein may have been an extreme practitioner, this behavior has gone unpunished for decades, is still going on, and follows an easily detectable pattern. While the reported attempts at a cover-up are stunning, they do not solve the puzzle of all the don't-call-them-enablers who must have known of this behavior and done nothing to stop it. Why did nobody speak up at the time? Do some men hold so much sway over their industry that its denizens conspire to protect them at all costs? As victims continue to tell their stories, the truth seems more complicated. What protected these predators was less a fortress of silence among bystanders, although surely there were a few who could have said more, but more a hedgerow of customs and attitudes and relationships that blocked most people from getting a full view of the sliminess. The thickest part of the hedgerow was fertilized by fear. The downside of accusing Weinstein, who continues, through a spokesperson, to deny any non-consensual sex, or publicly refusing to work with him, was steep. He was a guy who made things happen, for good or ill. He could save a movie, make a career, wrangle an Oscar out of the Academy, or crush a young hopeful's chances. And since his targets were nearly all young women, whether actresses or assistants at the opposite end of the power funnel, the cost-benefit analysis usually landed on Weinstein's side. Any who nevertheless spoke out were facing a very deep-pocketed campaign of public besmirching. Studies have consistently shown that people are much more willing to forgive if they believe their relationship with a transgressor is now or will be valuable to them. Those relationships could be valuable because the offender is a spouse or a parent or a benefactor. People are more likely to forgive their cheating partner than their cheating partner's paramour. They're more likely to overlook it when a boss borrows an object and is slow in returning it than when a colleague does. South Carolina's voters sent their adulterous former governor to Washington as a representative. So it's easy to see how Weinstein's plaudits or James Toback's credits or Kevin Spacey's star power could help people rationalize away the unpleasant stories about them as simply red-blooded American males trying their luck or terrible misunderstandings. After all, people hit on people every day. If you decline to work with them, you won't work with anyone. Those brave enough to kick up a fuss, but pragmatic enough to understand they would not be believed, were further silenced by non-disclosure agreements, NDAs. These were the hedgerow's thorns. They kept people in their place. Zelda Perkins, one of Weinstein's assistants in London in the 1990s, was the first to break her NDA, saying she had endured the mogul's harassment, which included being asked to watch him bathe and frequent requests for massages from almost the day she started working for him. She and another victim agreed to settle for about $250,000. Part of their agreement was that they were not allowed to keep a full copy of the NDA. Presto, no paper trail. A lot of Weinstein's employees were very young, getting their first shot at show business. A classic Weinstein method was to hire young staff and then train them in his methods. They didn't know, one told me, what the code of practice was. George Clooney asks, "Who is taking these actresses up to his room?" And the answer is, at least some of the time, novices who thought that actors taking meetings with producers was the way business was conducted. For years, accusations swirled around fashion photographer Terry Richardson. The producer of Miley Cyrus's famous Wrecking Ball video, he has always made work with sexual overtones. So when the accusations of harassment began to emerge, all of which Richardson denies, many in the fashion industry declined to take a side, wondering whether people were confusing Richardson's images with his behavior. It seemed hopelessly unsophisticated to kick up a fuss. But on October 23rd, Condé Nast announced it wouldn't work with him again. At the time that harassment is taking place, very few people have a 360-degree view of what's going on, except, again, the lawyers. In Weinstein's case, they were either naive, unable or unwilling to talk to others who had endured the same offenses, or terrified that further investigating the rumors they had heard would come at a very steep cost. It's almost as if Weinstein and others hid their dark secrets in a series of horcruxes that were extremely challenging to gather in one place. And finally, of course, when the predator is a money-making star like O'Reilly, or the boss like Chef John Besh, or considered to be excessively talented, as Kevin Spacey is, those around him generally get the message that the usual rules do not apply. The highly gifted are treated differently, their quirks tolerated. The story that a powerful faction of silencers keep the Weinsteins and Tobacks and Cosbys of the world from being discovered has some truth. But the bigger muzzle on the voices of victims is still the most mundane of human habits, the disinclination of non-victims to make a noise or protest about something that didn't happen to them. Whether it's in the church, in Silicon Valley, or in Hollywood, this is the environment that allows sexual predators to thrive. What remains to be seen is whether the rapid felling of guys who thought they had impunity will create a new environment, one in which people feel emboldened to speak up. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.